Hillary Clinton lost to Bernie Sanders here in Colorado by what looks like about 20 points. This was most evident to me about a week ago when both campaigns rolled out their legislative endorsements here at the Capitol in Denver. The Sanders campaign, out of 100 members of the legislature here, the Sanders campaign could only find three members of the House to come out and stand on the steps and declare their support for Sanders. When they did that, though, they were backed by 100 excited, sign-waving people, clearly, quote, feeling the burn. It was a, it was a rally.
This is very similar to what happened in New Hampshire, the entire Democratic leadership for Hillary Clinton, and yet Bernie Sanders won. And the Senate is very important now. Is that right, Corey Hutchins, and what's going now on now in Colorado?
Yeah, sure. There's a giant, race for the U.S. Senate. Michael Bennett is our Democratic senator here. He's a senior senator here in Colorado. And there are now officially 13 Republican candidates who are looking to take him on in November. Half of them will go through the grassroots caucus process, as they did last night, and the other half are going to petition onto the ballot and kind of take their message outside that grassroots meat grinder caucus system, and they're going to petition directly onto the ballot. And there's also a pretty closely watched congressional race here in Colorado. Mike Kaufman, the Republican congressman from District 6, a suburb of...
We're going to continue that on another day because our time clock is running out. But thank you so much to Corey Hutchins of the Colorado Independent and Dulce Sanz, Colorado State Director for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders, who won in Colorado, and Donna Murch of Rutgers University. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have the KBOO Evening News. This program has been made possible in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide for openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 26th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 5th through March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, and two films will show at the Hollywood Theater. The five-week-long festival of feature and documentary films come from all over the African continent and include Thursday evening documentary screenings, Family Film Day, and Women Filmmakers Week, held during the first week of March in celebration of Women's History Month. Again, that's 26th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, playing Thursday through Saturday until March 5th. Most of the films will screen at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street, in the Arts and Humanities Building in Room 104. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, KBOO's Robin Ryan shares a special segment covering Don't Shoot Portland's disruption at the Community Peace Collaborative's public forum.
And live in studio, a special interview with lead organizer for Don't Shoot Portland, Teresa Rayford. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The director of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality, Dick Peterson, has resigned, citing health reasons. Oregon's DEQ has been under fire due to recent discoveries of toxic air pollution in areas of East Portland. Despite recent public outcry calling for his resignation, many environmental advocates worry that Peterson is being framed as a fall guy, since the DEQ has been criticized for its lack of action on many local environmental issues since before his tenure.
In light of continuing discoveries of toxic pollution, the Eastside Portland Air Coalition is holding a rally at Pioneer Courthouse Square. The rally will focus on specific air quality demands, and after the rally, a letter listing public concerns will be delivered to the Department of Environmental Quality's office. The rally will be held tomorrow, Thursday, March 3rd, starting at noon.
The Pentagon is looking for hackers to hack their websites. In an effort to test their cybersecurity, the Pentagon has asked select hackers to ferret out security deficiencies of the Department of Defense's public websites. The Pentagon has yet to finalize all of the specifics of the program, but has stated that only U.S. citizens who have passed a background check may participate in the program. This program will not involve any weapons programs or sensitive data and will focus on a public computer system.
Yesterday's Super Tuesday presidential primary saw each party's front runner win seven states. Republican runner-up Ted Cruz managed to secure 226 votes to Trump's 319, while the remaining hopefuls Rubio, Kasich, and Carson trailed significantly behind. Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders came in 200 votes behind Clinton.
On Monday night, eight of Portland's 12 mayoral candidates debated at Revolution Hall. The Oregonian canceled its debate between the two frontrunners because of concerns about protests. Revolution Hall co-owner Jim Brunberg then quickly arranged this backup event, which included every interested candidate.
This morning, Governor Kate Brown signed Oregon's minimum wage increase into law. The law takes effect July 1st with a 50-cent increase in the statewide minimum wage. By 2022, Oregon will have the highest statewide minimum wage rates in the nation at $14.75 inside Portland's urban growth boundary, $13.50 in mid-sized counties, and $12.50 in rural areas.
A controversial bill that would have shielded the names of police officers who have used deadly force while on duty has died. The bill sat in the Senate Committee on Rules for a time, but ultimately was not voted on by the state Senate. The bill's creation came about in an effort to protect the officer involved in the shooting of Lavoie Finicum earlier this year.
More than 100 people gathered at the police station in Northeast Portland seeking an audience with the United States Attorney General, but Loretta Lynch was unable to make the first of three planned appearances scheduled for today. A variety of agencies and bureaus, as well as a contingent of social justice groups, were present, and among the initial speakers was a young man who recited a passage he had drafted to honor the sibling he lost to gang violence. Once the meeting was concluded, KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with area resident Michelle Darr and organizer Michael Colvin about their take on challenges and solutions associated with the state of policing in Portland.
You know, I've had enough. I've had enough with seeing mothers pouring their hearts out on the TV screen. I've had enough with my brothers and sisters thinking that bracken and cracking or roughing the block is where it's at. I've had enough with going to funerals and looking at my brothers in caskets. I'd rather see them walk across the stage as graduates. I've had enough of fathers thinking that the presence in a young boy's life doesn't matter. I've had enough with the stereotypes and nonsense that the media builds up. I've had enough of my brothers killing each other, and their excuse being, it's my turf. I've had enough with staying up countless hours thinking about, what if the bullet went a little left? Or maybe what if it went a little right? My brother will still be here today. I've had enough of wondering why my brother wasn't with us the night he was killed. I've had enough with the police brutality from Aaron Campbell to Freddie Gray. I've had enough of young men not being able to grow up to see their 21st birthday. I've had enough of the uncalled for beatings and mass murders. I've had enough of young men and women not realizing that they're hurting their own community with arson and these violent protests. When as a generation will we figure it out and stand up and say, I've had enough. Or better yet, we've had enough.
My name is Michelle Darr.
Can you tell me what brought you here today?
Well, I came here because I was under the impression that Loretta Lynch would be here today. A lot of us were. So we came down to ask for accountability, to ask for her to readdress this issue that she has stated that the Portland Police and the City of Portland is a nationwide leader in community policing. And we came here to challenge that. We came here to bring more to the table. We came here to ask for audits, to ask for accountability, and to ask that all the partners who are involved here in Portland in the policing structure, both the community policing members and the police department, come into full accountability, come to terms with the DOJ settlement, and abide by all of the agreements that that settlement covers. And that has not been done. In fact, there are many ways in which the police department has refused or is very, very slow to implement those terms of that agreement. And so what we are here to do today is to ask that the Attorney General put some pressure in this regard, rather than just coming out here and giving kudos to everybody for a job well done. We're saying the job is far from done, and it's time that we stand up as a community and ensure that that happens.
In the dynamics between the Portland Police Bureau and the community that it polices, what do you see as the biggest challenge, and what do you see as the most promising solutions?
Well, the biggest challenge are the huge disparities, obviously, in policing. We're here to address these disparities. As far as promising solutions, well, we really need to take this apart. We need to take the entire structure apart, get back to square one, reform and reformat the policing structure in this town in a way that is respectful of all citizens and all rights. I mean, it seems obvious. There's huge problems. Before kudos are being issued all over the place, we absolutely have to address this. It's hard to imagine how long that's going to be, but it needs to start now. Overall, the trust factor is not very high in this town.
I was hoping that there'd be a little more openness on the part of, you know, the people running the meeting to what grassroots activists in this community are saying. And we're not getting that kind of buy-in. I think we're getting a partial buy-in. And unfortunately, that doesn't really help the problem. Until all people have felt that they've been heard, I don't think we're going to make much progress on this issue. People need to be heard, and they need to know that the suffering and the problems they are facing are being recognized by people who are in charge of the city, in charge of various agencies that affect their lives very definitely. So that's one of the reasons why I was here. And then as a member of the National Council of FOR and what we're working on doing this summer in training people around using nonviolence as a way of bringing about change in a kind of movement sense, and putting these problems that we're facing here in Portland into a national context, because people who live in various cities around the country often feel like what they're going through is special, but it's not. Everybody who lives in a city that is a person of color or...
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch triggered protests that shut down a meeting at the Office of Youth Violence Prevention today. Lynch is in Portland. Efforts. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch triggered protests that shut down a meeting at the Office of Youth Violence Prevention today. Lynch is in Portland to address community policing groups as part of a program singling out Portland for its efforts. One of the people shutting down the meeting today was Don't Shoot Portland founder Teresa Rayford. She's with us live in the studio tonight, joined by Laura Vandelin, artist and community member of Don't Shoot Portland. Thank you both for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Teresa, let's start with you. Tell us, in a nutshell, what happened today.
Well, I've been going to the gang task force meeting since September of 2010 when my nephew was killed. And from 2010 to 2016, my activism and my engagement with community issues has escalated to where now I'm a community organizer. I do protest, but we're still on the political side of things. And so currently, these numbers that came out of Multnomah County about the disparities, the rates of youth incarceration, of black incarceration, of over-policing, seeing that the Attorney General for the United States, who knows that these protests are happening, that knows that protesters like myself are asking for audits and investigation into community policing, for her to come out here to commend and honor our police force that we know as a legitimate community is hindered by the relationships with community policing and community partners. Like, if we look at the profiling bill that we just passed through legislation, and we look at the partnerships of some of the groups that bring those together, and even if you look at what happened at that meeting today, every partner at that table has a job to go out and engage with people in the community and to bring that effort and that information back to that table. That bypasses the whole profiling issue, if you ask me, and goes right into an investigation. And so when we talk about those large numbers of people that are people of color, black people like myself, 500% more likely to be incarcerated, you have to understand there has to be some pattern of relationships that's identifying who they are and why they should be targeted as people that are being just... We're less than 10% of the population. 500% is a ridiculous number.
Yeah, you just touched on it right there. For listeners who aren't aware of it, can you give the statistics on the disparity in the rates of arrest and incarceration for members of the community of color versus the white population here in Portland?
Absolutely. And we actually had friends, my friend Sarah from the ACLU, and she brought me over a banner that shows these statistics. And this is part of the MacArthur report that came out of Multnomah County. But Multnomah County targets black people. Blacks in Multnomah County are 320% more likely to be stopped by the police. Let me see. I don't know why I changed the page on it. 500% more likely to serve jail time. 600% more likely to be sentenced to prison. Like, those numbers are ridiculous. You have to be making a serious effort to target those black individuals. And if community policing is being honored for its efforts, I want to see the quantifiable value of those efforts. And I want to make sure that their efforts are not undermining the privacy and the civil liberties of a lot of the people in our community that are dealing with community violence and poverty. We have a committee of education advocates that fight for our education equality within our school system right here in Portland. And we've seen that the FERPA laws and the rules of engagement along those lines, as far as it retains the privacy of these children, the ones in poverty are more likely to have their information through community partnerships given to law enforcement. So our whole demonstration today was to say you cannot award or honor that type of policing that undermines the safety and really prosperity of a whole community.
Well, getting back to today, why don't you paint the picture a little bit for our listeners? Who was there and what was happening?
Well, a lot of the different organizations were in attendance. If you've ever been to any of these gang task force meetings, usually you'll have representatives of different alternative programs, faith-based relationship organizations. I know that Penny Yakamoto from Ceasefire Oregon was there, and we've worked together on some things regarding gun legislation. There were different people from POIC, just different community partners and policing partners. But there were also members of our community like myself that are community victims. And so the family of Isaiah Kent was there. I was there as my nephew Andre Dupree Payton's auntie and continuing to be there. And so to see as a person who they haven't solved the crime. And we know that a lot of these crimes are probably by repeat offenders, and we know that the crimes are not being solved. The murders that we're talking about, the gang violence, they're not solving those problems. So, again, community policing, saying that that's a great effort and that we're being honored for it, if we still have the problem, as they opened the meeting with, the same issues from last year at the same time, if there's no gauge and change of that, then you're not doing a good job. And if my child's death is not enough for you to see that as a not value in the methodology, then there has to be something else. What you would have noticed at that meeting was that the attitude, people like myself, mm-hmm. when we're freshly victims, survivors, we're coddled and coffered and given all these, you know, opportunities to work as partners with community policing efforts. But at some point when we're asking for accountability or we're saying, hey, I feel like I'm being exploited, it becomes a defensive opportunity. So a lot of community members were able to see that kind of erupt. And I heard, you know, someone say it was a heckle. It wasn't a heckle. It was a very honest, filled opportunity to say, look, if you just listen to us and let us be off of your program and your record and actually work with us, then we do have a desire to not just be the ones that are getting the fingers pointed at us. I made a video, my friends were streaming, and we basically said, the children aren't the problem. You can't keep saying that they're killing each other because they're just like mad at the world. We're the ones who are the adults in this society. If our leaders aren't courageous enough to work with the actual families in these communities because they have to be pacified with, you know, Negro whispers or whatever you want to call these gatekeepers, then that's not our problem. That's the white establishment's problem. And if as a country we're saying Black Lives Matter and we want to fight white supremacy, then white Americans need to start looking at these people as not partners or comrades, but they're barriers to the success that we need. If the community doesn't come to the table when these barriers are there, you have to be conscious that maybe there is a trust issue, and maybe it's been exploited so much to the point to where we're not solving problems together as a community because we can't get there anymore.
I think they have like a deficit of, like, they just don't have a leadership. You know, and leadership to me looks like good customer service. It's just basic. Human courtesy is good customer service. If they just try to start from there, but they don't even have the desire to have that appearance of good customer service. You know, their whole attitude in that meeting this morning was just very hostile towards the public and very upset if you're not having a conversation about what they want to, the paid
it's
officials
like,
want
happy,
to.
Keep it friendly, keep
right.
it positive.
And this is
like,
a public forum.
We're talking
forum.
About death. You have five, you know, gang-related shootings. Why are we supposed to come in happy and cheerful?
Exactly. We're talking about people's lives. People cannot come into a space like that and talk about their child being murdered or their kid being kidnapped by the police or their children finding a gun and shooting each other without being upset. And I just hear everywhere in all of these type of meetings, like, you know, like, let's have some civility. Release the apathy, the silent apathy that is happening everywhere, you know, because that's way louder than the sorrow of mothers losing their children.
But Teresa, can you tell us a little bit about how you went from your nephew being killed to you're starting Don't Shoot Portland, and, you know, what transpired there and what really motivated you to go to the next level and start this as an organization?
Okay, well, when my nephew died, I kind of wrote up this manifesto called the Andre DePiri Payton Foundation, and it was basically my strategy of how I was going to engage with our community. And so I did everything from sit on committee boards, steering committees, attending testimonies, went back and forth to Salem and also to Washington, D.C. on gun legislation to just deal with those same issues of root core, the root cause issues, the poverty, the education system. I wanted to find out how we were getting access to guns in our community to where we had all of the community violence. I wanted to basically say, if you grow up and you graduate at 19 and you're dead before the next school year, what are the inequities in your life that keep you from being able to go off to college like any regular American person would have? You know, why in impoverished communities is that not the reality? Why are we burying our 19-year-olds? So I started really working as a community advocate, not even just doing that, also running for office and doing whatever I could to expose our community to the power players and the process of legislation and community engagement. And so all of that was just super active at the time that Mike Brown was murdered. I mean, everything from doing community town halls, workshops, or whatever. And when Ferguson happened, a community contacted me like in the middle of the night and was like, you know, Teresa, things are happening across the country because of Mike Brown. I mean, we got to do something in Portland, but we don't know what we should do and what should we do. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, you know, what do you want to do? Because, again, I'm running for office. I'm doing community engagement. I'm sitting on boards. I'm doing community advocacy. And they were like, well, we want to protest. And I was like, well, shoot, that's not really going to work, but let's do it and let's see what happens. And when I saw that at the rallies, just organizing and talking to the people, how everybody was ready to do their part. And I'm thinking like, whoa, for 4 years I've been running through these streets trying to get people to get engaged with the process, to come to these different tables. But community will come to community tables and will organize if community has access to resources. And a lot of those resources are pens and pencils and our opportunity to use our social networks. So we started doing outside of the bureaucracy and engaging on that level, along with just the whole Ferguson reality and being able to have access to like the ACLU or National Lawyers Guild. We were able to build the momentum to where like we're like really protesters and I'm like really a community organizer. And that all works into the same thing, because if Black Lives Matter and you're fighting police brutality and crime and violence and mass incarceration, you got to fight poverty. You got to fight education issues. You got to fight the health issues. You got to fight houselessness. You got to fight sexual violence and all those other things. And if you're not fighting those and you think you can beat the other thing before you get to those points, then you're going to continue to lose. And the way that the process is set up in our community, we're losing. We have every barrier right there funded, fully funded, but directly not associating itself in an engaged process with the community that can rise on its own. Community empowerment is a real thing. It's not a myth, you know?
And what else would you want to say about some of the issues that are facing the Black Lives Matter movement here in Portland, which is, we hear, the whitest city in America?
Well, outside of being investigated for using hashtags, you know, by the Department of Justice and other agencies, other than being assaulted while using our freedom of speech to engage in a global movement to promote the human rights and dignity that we all should desire and have, it's been hard. It's been extremely hard. We're a trending topic in this town. Our issues, everybody, no matter what levels we're on or what front we're on, they say, what does that have to do with Black lives? I went out to the state capitol to fight for $15 an hour and, you know, wanted to also address the issue with the House Bill 4087. And they were like, why are you bringing up all these different issues? And I was like, excuse me, if children in my community that were what you call drug dealers or just convicts or criminals had $15 an hour, or they could go to McDonald's and make it and they didn't have to work with that same embarrassment, like being a Black youth in America when all of the propaganda and all of the social norms say that you're a bad guy, it's already bad enough going outside. You ever have a kid that you bought them the cheap shoes 1 year and they were like, I don't want to wear those shoes outside? Well, the kid that gets kicked around all the time doesn't want to have to go to work to McDonald's. It's already being embarrassing. They already get picked on. They already feel like they're not going to make it. So that's another part of that. But having $15 an hour, well, shoot, I'm running over there, and I'm going to give it a chance, and maybe it might change my life. And they don't think that has anything to do with Black lives. Come on. We need something to help bring up a value in our community. And if economic power is not it, I don't know what it is.
It may be part of the problem, just simply one of branding, where you're not getting the attention that you deserve, and you're not being taken seriously, or maybe not seriously is the word, but you're not – your attention to these other issues aren't being paid attention to by the lawmakers in Salem because all they hear is don't shoot Portland, and they think, like you just said, well, why are you focusing on these other issues?
I think it's institutionalized censorship.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Maybe know, even within, our, within organizations, even though well-meaning, sometimes we still get caught up in our own white ego, and that's unfortunately, that's just the way it is, yeah. You know, because we're ingrained. We were trained to be to censor Black people. We were trained to do that from when we started school, you know, and perhaps even our own parents trained us that way because they were institutionalized and trained to be that way. We just need to be aware of it when we're doing it because we do it all the time.
And as I was noticing, like with our white allyship, we can bring it back to what happened today. There's people that are saying, I understand what you're going to, but you should be more like this person, and maybe you can get your... No, I'm not going to be like somebody else. Why can't I be my nephew's aunt? Why can't I be my son's mother? Why can't I be the person that I was raised to be, the person I honor who I am? But I have to change my attitude in order to support the improvement of my life and the future and the desires of our children. That's insane for people to put us in that type of position to say that that's where we should be regulated. I mean, that's impossible to believe that it exists, but in our society, I mean, I moved to Texas for 15 years. When I came back home, everybody was talking about crabs in a barrel and gatekeepers and all of this. And I heard somebody say the other day, well, who made the barrel? Who put that barrel in place to where everybody had to go in there and fight each other for resources? And that's a valid thing. When you look at all of these different organizations that are on the top of equity or Black anything, any kind, they're not, they don't look like me. Maybe the people that are subservient to them that are running the directorship of this part of it do, but the program developers don't look like me, the ones building those resources. If your oppressor was the same person that was manufacturing your distributable resources, you're not going to you're not going to trust the overseer. You're not going to trust the gatekeeper. If you guys still have that type of relationship, then that's not real. That's a serious barrier. If we're really equal, if we're really going into a different type of society, we have to start connecting. We have to start saying, you know what? Let me respect this person. I don't have to ask Joanne who she is and if I should listen to her or if I should invite her to the thing or something. You know, you don't have to pick somebody that you know that looks like me to get their value aspect on who I am before you have a perspective of who you think I should be or who I might be.
That's really interesting. So has it been your experience that some of the same systemic barriers that you encounter in day-to-day life are the same ones that you run into in the advocacy community?
I see so much of it that it hurts. It hurts. If the advocacy feelings in our activist community, if we see or hear, if I have a really close friend, their relationship can undermine our movement based on an attitude or an ego. And what we have to understand as society is that Black America is in a lot of pain, and it's very generational. And so the things that we're dealing with, we have to deal with, but other people can't come in and pick sides. That undermines everything that we're all doing. Let us trip with each other and all that good stuff, but if you pick sides, if you get in and you undermine the values of all of us, then you're not really helping your friends either. You're putting them in a position to where they're going to be called a gatekeeper, you know, and, scapegoats and all those different words. We don't have to be.
So in light of all these barriers and all these traumas, what is Don't Shoot Portland's vision for politically empowering Portlanders?
Well, we're a community action plan, so most of our vision is the continuing of education and outreach. We want to continue building our workshops. We want to continue building our education committee. Right now, we're working on direct outreach with parents whose children are pushed out of school so that we can start building just ways that we can get more connected or better connected with our new school board and start making sure that outside of requests for audits, which is driving the city crazy, but we need to see where we're at in order to start building, you know, outside of that, just seeing what we can do with the values that we're going to see with the outcomes from knowing what's wrong. You have to start somewhere. So audits, investigations.
I remember when
asking for indictments.
I remember we were at an MBDA training and somebody asked Trissa, what is it that you're trying to accomplish? And Trissa's was like very matter of fact, just trying to find out what is it that says it's okay to kill a Black life? And then once you find that out, to dismantle it. And I just thought that is really just getting to the root of the problems is what Don't Shoot Portland continues to do and has done from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know.
All right, we've only got 1 minute left.
We did good.
Well, there's so much more that we should cover, and sadly we can't do it this afternoon, but with the time we have left, let everyone know, how can they get involved, what can they do, what are the best things that they could do to help this movement?
All right. Well, we just we have a Facebook page, which is Don't Shoot Portland. It's on Facebook, no apostrophe. You can find us there, like us, share, come to some of our events. But we also got into a new partnership with Flossin Media and Mr. John Jackson and NEBA, the North Northeast Neighborhood Business Association. So we're over at 311 North Ivy, and pretty soon we'll be announcing our community workshops on our Facebook page. So you can find us that way. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Laura, Teresa, for joining us today. This has been fascinating. I wish we didn't have to cover this, but I'm glad that you guys were here to give us this info.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview by Mike Crenshaw. This will be followed by Treasures from the KBOO Archives at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers. The high will be 61 and the low 45 for tomorrow evening. The quote of the day is from actor Danny Strong, who said,
idealism loses to pragmatism when it comes to winning elections.
In today's community rights commentary, Paul Cienfuego looks into what happened when the Oregonians' mayoral debate took on a life of its own.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today's commentary and next week's commentary will continue to focus on the extraordinary turn of events that have taken place over these past 3 weeks regarding the Oregonian newspaper's attempt to pre-select our next mayor for us. Last week, I reported on the Oregonians' plan to hold what they claimed was a mayoral debate. It was scheduled to take place last night at Revolution Hall in southeast Portland. Of course, it wasn't going to be a real debate, as the Oregonian had invited only 2 of the 12 registered candidates, Ted Wheeler and Jules Bailey, claiming that they were the, quote, front runners, unquote, and the only 2 who had any chance of winning the race, so why bother inviting anyone else? The level of arrogance that this demonstrated among the paper's decision makers is truly off the charts, given that the filing deadline for mayor hasn't even passed yet, that in fact there are numerous very interesting and competent candidates running, and last but not least, that there have been no voter surveys done yet to determine who the front runners actually are. So how can the Oregonian claim who is and is not a leading candidate? It's absurd, and a lot of local voters figured this out pretty early in the game and started to deluge the Oregonian's event page on Facebook with angry comments about the decision to exclude so many candidates. The pressure against the Oregonian started to take its toll, and as early as February 9, the Oregonian was forced to publicly defend its decision, claiming that the debate's audience time would be wasted if people had to listen to any candidates other than Ted Wheeler and Jules Bailey. Less than 2 weeks ago, I had a somewhat crazy idea that an action alert should be issued, directed at the Oregonian's management, insisting that they either host a real debate open to all registered candidates or risk having their event canceled through mass nonviolent civil disobedience. A few days later, 4 of us launched our action alert on Facebook, hosted by Portland's Right to the City Coalition. Officially, our demand was entirely ignored by the newspaper's management, but I've been involved in enough nonviolent direct action campaigns in my decades of political activism to know that the power holders are always paying very close attention when nonviolent civil disobedience is threatened. As abolitionist and former slave Frederick Douglass said in 1857, quote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you've found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or with both." Unquote. If we wanted to put real pressure on the Oregonian to open its debate to other candidates, an actual demand was necessary. 2 days before the planned event, we started to assume that the Oregonian really wasn't going to budge, and we went into high gear doing our final crowd coordination and nonviolent civil disobedience planning. So we were as shocked as everyone else when the Oregonian announced on Sunday that the event was canceled. Their explanation as to why was quite disingenuous, as it tends to be when power holders are outsmarted by public citizens. They claimed that they feared for the safety of their invited candidates and audience, and twice used the word threat in their announcement. Yes, our small group of local voters was indeed a threat, but not to anyone's physical safety. We were a threat to the corporate media institution getting what it wants all the time, in all situations, with no interference from the rabble, the unwashed masses, i.e., the general public, who are normally treated merely as an irritation. By yesterday morning, we were beginning to realize what a huge victory we had won. The Oregonian had crumpled. There'd be no pseudo-debate after all. And just as we were starting to plan a victory celebration for last night instead of a nonviolent action, there was another wild turn of events. The Oregonian's editorial board published a scathing attack against their own 2 chosen mayoral candidates and blamed the event cancellation squarely on the candidates' shoulders.
Then-candidate Ted Wheeler tried a slick political maneuver that actually worked and instantly turned the canceled event into an all-candidate town hall, with a total of 8 mayoral candidates agreeing to participate with only a few hours to prepare, and with a wonderful diversity of moderators chosen by one of the owners of Revolution Hall, who had previously tried unsuccessfully to convince the Oregonian to open their debate to more candidates. And the debate proceeded exactly as our ad hoc group had always hoped that it would, as an open event with all candidates invited and no interference from the corporate media. It was a huge victory for Portland voters. There's still much to report about this extraordinary week in Portland politics, so I will continue my tale next week. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Dan Raphael, and Sarah Meyer. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, Linda Olson-Osterlin, guest host. She'll be speaking with Josie Setzler of Witness Against Torture about Obama's plan for Guantanamo, indefinite detention. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fogering examines the American nightmare. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we hear an interview with the late writer Umberto Eco from 2005. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, a monthly program featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not currently a member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And now it's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer. Yes, it is that time again. News from the Boo, our weekly program, Wednesdays at or around 5:45, when we hear from folks inside of KBOO about what's going on inside of and around KBOO. Phone lines will be open tonight. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Tonight we are talking with Mike Crenshaw, who has been a station co-manager here at KBOO for 2 years. Good evening.
Hey, what's happening?
So Mike is transitioning his role to focus on youth and hip-hop outreach, and tonight you're going to be talking with us a little bit about that new role at KBOO. Is that right?
Yep.
So you and Monica have been here a little over 2 years sharing the role of station co-manager, and you applied for that role together initially. Mm-hmm. You've been working together, sharing that role, supporting each other, and now things are going to change just a bit. So why don't you tell us about that?
So after 2 years of team management with Monica and I as co-managers, I decided that I needed to transition and focus on things that are a little bit more central to what I'm passionate about. And youth and outreach work through hip hop is what that's going to look like as far as my relationship to KBOO. So I'm going to still be here, but not as a manager. I'll be working as a contractor and focusing on youth and hip hop outreach. And some of the things that I'd like to get going over the next few months are a series of battles here at KBOO as a way of bringing in some of the best hip hop artists in the city. I want to say that it's also reminiscent of one of the ways that I got introduced to KBOO over 20 years ago as a young MC trying to establish myself in the independent hip hop scene here in Portland was to participate in two battles. And that kind of established me as an artist in the city. So I want to bring that back as a feature of hip hop in KBOO. There'll be other things too. There'll be classes examining different aspects of history and culture related to hip hop. So yeah, it's in process. It's developing. It's brand new.
So how quickly are we can we expect to see some of these things happening?
Later this month. So I have to. Yesterday was my last day as manager. Today is my first day as a contractor. So things are going to take a little bit of time. But I'm looking at trying to either before I go to bed tonight or during the day tomorrow, I'll have some events actually scheduled. As it stands, I've got March 19th as an opportunity. I'll be subbing on the Soundbox that night. It's a Saturday night from 10 to 12, and I'll be playing some music from the Hip Hop Caravan over the past 3 years. You know, we've recorded and I've gotten music from artists. But I'm also looking at taking the second Saturday of every month and possibly making that the day for the battles. Also, been talking something that's in development is a partnership with Platinum Records and hopefully getting some of the professional turntablist hip-hop DJs to teach some hands-on classes about hip-hop turntablism with two turntables and a mixer here at the facility over the next year or so.
So in this new role, what impact are you hoping to have on KBOO and the community at large? You mentioned this was kind of where you got your start as a young MC. So are you hoping to pass the torch a little bit?
Yeah, I'm always looking to expand opportunities and platforms for people who are passionate about hip hop to be able to participate and get exposure and also sharpen their skills amongst other people who are very serious about what they're doing and have fun and learn and just grow as artists.